Yes. Only he had already locked the bathroom door from the inside, and because it was too much of a bother to unlock it again, he had simply opened the window over the tub and gone down the side of the house like a fly crawling down a wall. Sure, of course, sure. Panic was rising in her mind again. It was like bitter black coffee threatening to overflow the rim of a cup. She closed her eyes and fought against it. She stood there, perfectly still, a pale statue with the pulse beating in its throat. Now she could remember running back down here, feet stuttering on the stair levels, running for the phone. Oh, yes. Oh, sure. But who had she meant to call? Crazily, she thought, I would call the turtle, but the turtle couldn't help us. It didn't matter anyway. She had gotten as far as O, and she must have said something not quite standard because the operator had asked if she had a problem. She had one, all right. But how did you tell that faceless voice that Stanley had locked himself in the bathroom and didn't answer her, that the steady sound of the water dripping into the tub was killing her heart? Someone had to help her. Someone. She put the back of her hand into her mouth and deliberately bit down on it. She tried to think, tried to force herself to think. The spare keys in the kitchen cupboard. She got going, and one slippered foot kicked the bag of buttons resting beside her chair. Some of the buttons spilled out, glittering like glazed eyes in the lamplight. She saw at least half a dozen black ones. Mounted inside the door of the cupboard over the double basin sink was a large varnished board in the shape of a key. One of Stan's clients had made it in his workshop and given it to him two Christmases ago. The keyboard was studded with small hooks, and swinging on these were all the keys the house took, two duplicates of each to a hook. Beneath each hook was a strip of mystic tape, each strip lettered in Stan's small, neat printing. Garage, attic, downstairs bath, upstairs bath, front door, back door. Off to one side were ignition key dupes labeled MB and Volvo. Patty snatched the key marked upstairs bath, began to run for the stairs, and then made herself walk. Running made the panic want to come back, and the panic was too close to the surface as it was. Also, if she just walked, maybe nothing would be wrong. Or if there was something wrong, God could look down, see she was just walking, and think, oh, good, I pulled a hell of a boner, but I've got time to take it all back. Walking as sedately as a woman on her way to a ladies' book circle meeting, she went up the stairs and down to the closed bathroom door. Stanley? She called, trying the door again at the same time, suddenly more afraid than ever, not wanting to use the key because having to use the key was somehow too final. If God hadn't taken it back by the time she used the key, then he never would. The age of miracles, after all, was past. But the door was still locked. The deliberate plink, pause, of dripping water was her only answer. Her hand was shaking, and the key chattered all the way around the plate before finding its way into the keyhole and socking itself home. She turned it and heard the lock snap back. She fumbled for the cut glass knob. It tried to slide through her hand again, not because the door was locked this time, but because her palm was wet with sweat. She firmed her grip and made it turn. She pushed the door open. Stanley? Stanley? She looked at the tub with its blue shower curtain bunched at the far end of the stainless steel rod and forgot how to finish her husband's name. She simply stared at the tub, her face as solemn as the face of a child on her first day at school. In a moment she would begin to scream, and Anita McKenzie next door would hear her, and it would be Anita McKenzie who would call the police, convinced that someone had broken into the Uris house and that people were being killed over there. But for now, this one moment, Patty Uris simply stood silent with her hands clasped in front of her against her dark cotton skirt, her face solemn, her eyes huge. And now the look of almost holy solemnity began to transform itself into something else. The huge eyes began to bulge. The mouth pulled back into a dreadful grin of horror. She wanted to scream and couldn't. The screams were too big to come out. The bathroom was lit by fluorescent tubes. It was very bright. There were no shadows. You could see everything, whether you wanted to or not. The water in the tub was bright pink. Stanley lay with his head propped against the rear of the tub. His head had rolled so far back on his neck that strands of his short black hair brushed the skin between his shoulder blades. If his staring eyes had been capable of seeing, she would have looked upside down to him. His mouth hung open like a sprung door. His expression was one of abysmal frozen horror. A package of Gillette Platinum Plus razor blades lay on the rim of the tub. He had slit his inner forearms open from wrist to the crook of the elbow, and then had crossed each of these cuts just below the bracelets of fortune, making a pair of bloody capital T's. The gashes glared red-purple in the harsh white light. She thought the exposed tendons and ligaments looked like cuts of cheap beef. A drop of water gathered at the lip of the shiny chromium faucet. It grew fat. Grew pregnant, you might say. It sparkled. It dropped. Plink. He had dipped his right forefinger in his own blood and had written a single word on the blue tiles above the tub, written it in two huge, staggering letters. A zigzagging, bloody finger mark fell away from the second letter of this word. His finger had made that mark, she saw, as his hand fell into the tub where it now floated. She thought Stanley must have made that mark, his final impression on the world, as he lost consciousness. It seemed to cry out at her. It. Another drop fell into the tub. Plink. That did it. Patty Urs at last found her voice, staring into her husband's dead and sparkling eyes. She began to scream. 2. Richard Tozier takes a powder. Rich felt like he was doing pretty good until the vomiting started. He had listened to everything Mike Hanlon told him, said all the right things, answered Mike's questions, even asked a few of his own. He was vaguely aware that he was doing one of his voices, not a strange and outrageous one, like those he sometimes did on the radio. Kinky Briefcase, sexual accountant, was his own personal favorite, at least for the time being, and positive listener response on Kinky was almost as high as for his listener's all-time favorite, Colonel Buford Kissdrivel. But a warm, rich, confident voice. An I'm all right voice. It sounded great, but it was a lie. Just like all the other voices were lies. How much do you remember, Rich? Mike asked him. Very little, Rich said, and then paused. Enough, I suppose. Will you come? I'll come, Rich said, and hung up. He sat in his study for a moment, leaning back in the chair behind his desk, looking out at the Pacific Ocean. A couple of kids were down on the left, horsing around on their surfboards, not really riding them. There wasn't much surf to ride. The clock on the desk, an expensive LED quartz that had been a gift from a record company rep, said that it was 5:09 p.m. on May 28, 1985. It would, of course, be 3 hours later where Mike was calling from. Dark already. He felt a prickle of goose flesh at that, and he began to move, to do things. First, of course, he put on a record. Not hunting, just grabbing blindly among the thousands racked on the shelves. Rock and roll was almost as much a part of his life as the voices. And it was hard for him to do anything without music playing, and the louder the better. The record he grabbed turned out to be a Motown retrospective. Marvin Gaye, one of the newer members of what Rich sometimes called the All Dead Band, came on singing, I Heard It Through the Grapevine. Ooh-hoo, I bet you're wondering how I knew. Not bad, Rich said. He even smiled a little. This was bad, and it had admittedly knocked him for a loop, but he felt that he was going to be able to handle it. No sweat. He began getting ready to go back home, and at some point during the next hour it occurred to him that it was as if he had died and had yet been allowed to make all his own final business dispositions, not to mention his own funeral arrangements. And he felt as if he was doing pretty good. He tried the travel agent he used, thinking she would probably be on the freeway and headed home by now, but taking a shot on the off chance. For a wonder, he caught her in. He told her what he needed, and she asked him for 15 minutes. I owe you one, Carol, he said. They had progressed from Mr. Tozier and Ms. Feeney to Rich and Carol over the last 3 years. Pretty chummy, considering they had never met face to face. All right, pay off, she said. Can you do Kinky Briefcase for me? Without even pausing, if you had to pause to find your voice, there was usually no voice there to be found, Rich said, Kinky Briefcase, sexual accountant here. I had a fellow come in the other day who wanted to know what the worst thing was about getting AIDS. His voice had dropped slightly. At the same time, its rhythm had speeded up and become jaunty. It was clearly an American voice, and yet it somehow conjured up images of a wealthy British colonial chappie who was as charming, in his muddled way, as he was addled. Rich hadn't the slightest idea who Kinky Briefcase really was, but he was sure he always wore white suits, red Esquire, and drank things which came in tall glasses and smelled like coconut-scented shampoo.
I told him right away, trying to explain to your mother how you picked it up from a Haitian girl. Until next time, this is Kinky Briefcase, sexual accountant, saying, you need my card if you can't get hard.
Carol Feeney screamed with laughter.
That's perfect, perfect. My boyfriend says he doesn't believe you can just do those voices. He says it's got to be a voice filter gadget or something.
Just talent, my dear, Rich said. Kinky Briefcase was gone. W.C. Fields, top hat, red nose, golf bags, and all was here. I'm so stuffed with talent I have to plug up all my bodily orifices to keep it from just running out like, well, just running out. She went off into another screamy gale of laughter, and Rich closed his eyes. He could feel the beginnings of a headache. Be a dear and see what you can do, would you? He asked, still being W.C. Fields, and hung up on her laughter. Now he had to go back to being himself, and that was hard. It got harder to do that every year. It was easier to be brave when you were someone else. He was trying to pick out a pair of good loafers and had about decided to stick with sneakers when the phone rang again. It was Carol Feeney, back in record time. He felt an instant urge to fall into the Buford kiss dribble voice and fought it off. She had been able to get him a first-class seat on the American Airlines red-eye nonstop from LAX to Boston. He would leave L.A. at 9:03 p.m. and arrive at Logan about 5 o'clock tomorrow morning. Delta would fly him out of Boston at 7:30 a.m. and into Bangor, Maine at 8:20. She had gotten him a full-sized sedan from Avis, and it was only 26 miles from the Avis counter at Bangor International Airport to the Derrytown line.
Only 26 miles? Rich thought. Is that all, Carol? Well, maybe it is, in miles anyway. But you don't have the slightest idea how far it really is to Derry, and I don't either. But oh God, oh dear God, I am going to find out.
I didn't try for a room because you didn't tell me how long you'd be there, she said. Do you?
No, let me take care of that, Rich said.
And then Buford Kissdribble took over.
You've been a peach, my dear, a Georgia peach, a cause.
He hung up gently on her, always leave him laughing, and then dialed 207 555-1212 for State of Maine Directory Assistance. He wanted a number for the Derry Townhouse.
God, there was a name from the past.
He hadn't thought of the Derry Townhouse in, what, 10 years, 20, 25 years even? Crazy as it seemed, he guessed it had been at least 25 years, and if Mike hadn't called, he supposed he might never have thought of it again in his life. And yet there had been a time in his life when he had walked past that great red brick pile every day. And on more than one occasion he had run past it, with Henry Bowers and Belch Huggins and that other big boy, Victor somebody or other, in hot pursuit, all of them yelling little pleasantries like,
We're gonna get you, fuckface. Gonna get you, you little smartass. Gonna get you, you four-eyed faggot. Had they ever gotten him?
Before Rich could remember, an operator was asking him what city, please.
In Derry, operator. Derry? God. Even the word felt strange and forgotten in his mouth, saying it was like kissing an antique.
Do you have a number for the Derry townhouse?
One moment, sir. No way. It'll be gone. Raised in an urban renewal program, changed into an Elks Hall or a Bowl-a-Drome or an electric Dreamscape video arcade. Or maybe burned down one night when the odds finally ran out on some drunk shoe salesman smoking in bed. All gone, Richie. Just like the glasses Henry Bowers always used to rag you about. What's that Springsteen song say? Glory days, gone in the wink of a young girl's eye.
What young girl?
Why, Bev, of course. Bev.
Changed the townhouse might be, but gone it apparently was not, because a blank robotic voice now came on the line and said,
The number is 941-8282. Repeat, the number is...
But Rich had gotten it the first time. It was a pleasure to hang up on that droning voice. It was too easy to imagine some great globular directory assistance monster buried somewhere in the earth, sweating rivets and holding thousands of telephones and thousands of jointed chromium tentacles. The Ma Bell version of Spidey's nemesis, Dr. Octopus.
Each year the world Rich lived in felt more and more like a huge electronic haunted house in which digital ghosts and frightened human beings lived in uneasy coexistence. Still standing, to paraphrase Paul Simon, still standing after all these years. He dialed the hotel he had last seen through the horn-rimmed spectacles of his childhood. Dialing that number, 1-207-941-8282, was fatally easy. He held the telephone to his ear, looking out his study's wide picture window. The surfers were gone. A couple was walking slowly up the beach, hand in hand, where they had been. The couple could have been a poster on the wall of the travel agency where Carol Feeney worked. That was how perfect they were. Except, that was, for the fact they were both wearing glasses.
Gonna get you, fuckface. Gonna break your glasses.
Chris, his mind sent up abruptly. His last name was Chris. Victor Chris. Oh, Christ, that was nothing he wanted to know, not at this late date. But it didn't seem to matter in the slightest. Something was happening down there in the vaults, down there where Rich Tozier kept his own personal collection of golden oldies. Doors were opening. Only they're not records down there, are they? Down there, you're not Rich Records Tozier, hotshot KLAD DJ and the man of 1,000 voices, are you? And those things that are opening, they aren't exactly doors, are they? He tried to shake these thoughts off. Thing to remember is that I'm okay. I'm okay, you're okay. Rich Tozier's okay. Could use a cigarette is all. He had quit 4 years ago, but he could use one now, all right. They're not records, but dead bodies. You buried them deep, but now there's some kind of crazy earthquake going on, and the ground is spitting them up to the surface. You're not Rich Records Tozier down there. Down there, you're just Richie Four Eyes Tozier. And you're with your buddies, and you're so scared it feels like your balls are turning into Welch's grape jelly. Those aren't doors, and they're not opening. Those are crypts, Richie. They're cracking open, and the vampires you thought were dead are all flying out again. A cigarette, just one. Even a Carlton would do, for Christ's sweet sake.
Gonna get you, Four Eyes. Gonna make you eat that fucking book bag.
Townhouse,
a male voice with a Yankee tang said. It had traveled all the way across New England, the Midwest, and under the casinos of Las Vegas to reach his ear. Rich asked the voice if he could reserve a suite of rooms at the townhouse beginning tomorrow. The voice told him he could, and then asked him for how long.
I can't say. I've got...
He paused briefly, minutely. What did he have, exactly? In his mind's eye, he saw a boy with a tartan book bag running from the tough guys. He saw a boy who wore glasses, a thin boy with a pale face that had somehow seemed to scream,
"Hit me! Go on and hit me!"
in some mysterious way to every passing bully.
"Here's my lips. Mash them back against my teeth. Here's my nose. Bloody it for sure and break it if you can. Box an ear so it swells up like a cauliflower. Split an eyebrow. Here's my chin. Go for the knockout button. Here are my eyes, so blue and so magnified behind these hateful, hateful glasses, these horn-rimmed specks, one bow of which is held on with adhesive tape. Break the specks. Drive a shard of glass into one of these eyes and close it forever. What the hell?"
He closed his eyes and said, "I've got business in Derry, you see. I don't know how long the transaction will take. How about 3 days with an option to renew?"
"An option to renew?"
the desk clerk asked doubtfully. And Rich waited patiently for the fellow to work it over in his mind.
"Oh, I get you. That's very good.
Thank you, and I, hope you can vote for us in November,"
John F. Kennedy said.
"Jackie wants to, do over the, Oval Office, and I've got a job all lined up for my, brother Bobby."
"Mr. Tozier?"
"Yes."
"Okay. Somebody else got on the line there for a few seconds."
Just an old pal from the DOP, Rich thought. That's dead old party, in case you should wonder. Don't worry about it. A shudder worked through him, and he told himself again, almost desperately, "You're okay, Rich." "I heard it, too," Rich said. "Must have been a line crossover. How are we looking on that room?"
"Oh, there's no problem with that," the clerk said. "We do business here in Derry, but it really never booms."
"Is that so?"
"Oh, yeah,"
the clerk agreed, and Rich shuddered again. He had forgotten that, too. That simple northern New Englandism for yes.
"Oh, yeah.
Gonna get you, creep."
The ghostly voice of Henry Bowers screamed, and he felt more crypts cracking open inside of him. The stench he smelled was not decayed bodies, but decayed memories. And that was somehow worse.
He gave the townhouse clerk his American Express number and hung up. Then he called Steve Koval, the KLAD program director.
"What's up, Rich?"
Steve asked. The last Arbitron ratings had shown KLAD at the top of the cannibalistic Los Angeles FM rock market, and ever since then, Steve had been in an excellent mood. Thank God for small favors.
"Well, you might be sorry you asked," he told Steve. "I'm taking a powder."
"Taking?" He could hear the frown in Steve's voice.
"I don't think I get you, Rich."
"I have to put on my boogie shoes. I'm going away."
"What do you mean, going away?
According to the log I have right here in front of me, you're on the air tomorrow from 2 in the afternoon until 6 p.m., just like always. In fact, you're interviewing Clarence Clemens in the studio at 4. You know Clarence Clemens, Rich? As in, come on and blow, big man?"
Clemens can talk to Mike O'Hara as well as he can talk to me.
"Clarence doesn't want to talk to Mike, Rich. Clarence doesn't want to talk to Bobby Russell. He doesn't want to talk to me. Clarence is a big fan of Buford Kiss Drivel and Wyatt the Homicidal Bag Boy. He wants to talk to you, my friend, and I have no interest in having a pissed-off 250-pound saxophone player who was once almost drafted by a pro football team running amok in my studio."
"I don't think he has a history of running amok," Rich said.
"I mean, we're talking Clarence Clemens here, not Keith Moon." There was silence on the line. Rich waited patiently.
"You're not serious, are you?"
Steve finally asked. He sounded plaintive.
"I mean, unless your mother just died or you've got to have a brain tumor out or something, this is called crapping out."
"I have to go, Steve."
"Is your mother sick? Did she, God forbid, die?"
"She died 10 years ago."
"Have you got a brain tumor?"
"Not even a rectal polyp."
"This is not funny, Rich."
"No.
You're being a fucking busher, and I don't like it."
"I don't like it either, but I have to go."
"Where? Why? What is this? Talk to me, Rich."
"Someone called me. Someone I used to know a long time ago, in another place. Back then, something happened. I made a promise. We all promised that we would go back if the something started happening again. And I guess it has."
"What something are we talking about, Rich?"
"I'd just as soon not say.
Also, you'll think I'm crazy if I tell you the truth. I don't remember."
"When did you make this famous promise?" "A long time ago, in the summer of 1958. There was another long pause, and he knew Steve Koval was trying to decide if Rich Records Tozier, a.k.a. Buford Kiss Drivel, a.k.a. Wyatt the Homicidal Bag Boy, etc., etc., was having him on or was having some kind of mental breakdown.
"You would have been just a kid,"
Steve said flatly.
11, going on 12.
Another long pause. Rich waited patiently.
"All right," Steve said. "I'll shift the rotation. Put Mike in for you. I can call Chuck Foster to pull a few shifts, I guess, if I can find what Chinese restaurant he's currently holed up in. I'll do it because we go back a long way together. But I'm never going to forget you bushed out on me, Rich."
"Oh, get down off it," Rich said. But the headache was getting worse. He knew what he was doing. Did Steve really think he didn't?
"I need a few days off is all. You're acting like I took a shit on our FCC charter."
"A few days off for what? The reunion of your Cub Scout pack in Shithouse Falls, North Dakota, or Pussy Hump City, West Virginia?"
"Actually, I think Shithouse Falls in Arkansas, Bo,"
Buford Kissdribble said in his big hollow barrel voice. But Steve was not to be diverted.
"Because you made a promise when you were 11? Kids don't make serious promises when they're 11, for Christ's sake.
And it's not even that, Rich, and you know it. This is not an insurance company. This is not a law office. This is show business, be it ever so humble, and you fucking well know it. If you had given me a week's notice, I wouldn't be holding this phone in one hand and a bottle of my Lanta in the other. You are putting my balls to the wall, and you know it. So don't you insult my intelligence."
Steve was nearly screaming now, and Rich closed his eyes.
"I'm never going to forget it," Steve had said, and Rich supposed he never would. But Steve had also said kids didn't make serious promises when they were 11, and that wasn't true at all. Rich couldn't remember what the promise had been, wasn't sure he wanted to remember, but it had been plenty serious.
"Steve, I have to."
"Yeah, and I told you I could handle it, so go ahead. Go ahead, you busher."
"Steve, this is rid..."
But Steve had already hung up. Rich put the phone down. He had barely started away from it when it began to ring again, and he knew without picking it up that it was Steve again, madder than ever. Talking to him at this point would do no good. Things would just get uglier.
He slid the switch on the side of the phone to the right, cutting it off in mid-ring. He went upstairs, pulled two suitcases out of the closet, and filled them with the barely glanced-at conglomeration of clothes. Jeans, shirts, underwear, socks. It would not occur to him until later that he had taken nothing but kid clothes. He carried the suitcases back downstairs. On the den wall was a black-and-white Ansel Adams photograph of Big Sur. Rich swung it back on hidden hinges, exposing a barrel safe. He opened it, pawed his way past the paperwork. The house here, poised cozily between the fault line and the brush fire zone, 20 acres of timberland in Idaho, a bunch of stocks. He had bought the stocks seemingly at random. When his brokers saw Rich coming, he immediately clutched his head. But the stocks had all risen steadily over the years. He was sometimes surprised by the thought that he was almost, not quite, but almost, a rich man. All courtesy of rock and roll music. And the voices, of course. House, acres, stocks, insurance policy, even a copy of his last will and testament. The strings that bind you tight to the map of your life, he thought. There was a sudden wild impulse to whip out his Zippo and light it up. The whole whore's combine of wherefores and know ye all men by these presents and the bearer of this certificate is entitled. And he could do it, too. The papers in his safe had suddenly ceased to signify anything. The first real terror struck him then, and there was nothing at all supernatural about it. It was only a realization of how easy it was to trash your life. That was what was so scary. You just dragged the fan up to everything you had spent the years raking together and turned the motherfucker on. Easy. Burn it up or blow it away, then just take a powder. Behind the papers, which were only currency's second cousins, was the real stuff, the cash. $4,000 in tens, twenties, and fifties. Taking it now, stuffing it into the pocket of his jeans, he wondered if he hadn't somehow known what he was doing when he put the money in here. $50 one month, $120 the next, maybe only $10 the month after that. Rat hole money. Taking a powder money. Man, that's scary, he said, barely aware he had spoken. He was looking blankly out the big window at the beach. It was deserted now, the surfers gone, the honeymooners, if that was what they had been, gone too. Ah, yes, Doc. It all comes back to me now. Remember Stanley Uris, for instance? Bet your fur I do. Remember how we used to say that and think it was so cool? Stanley Urin, the big kids called him. Hey, Urin. Hey, you fucking Christ killer. Where you going? One of your fag friends gonna give you a BJ? He slammed the safe door shut and swung the picture back into place. When had he last thought of Stan Uris? 5 years ago? 10? 20? Rich and his family had moved away from Derry in the spring of 1960, and how fast all of their faces faded. His gang, that pitiful bunch of losers with their little clubhouse in what had been known then as the Barrens. Funny name for an area as lush with growth as that place had been. Kidding themselves that they were jungle explorers or seabees carving out a landing strip on a Pacific atoll while they held off the Japs. Kidding themselves that they were dam builders, cowboys, spacemen on a jungle world, you name it. But whatever you name it, don't let's forget what it really was. It was hiding. Hiding from the big kids. Hiding from Henry Bowers and Victor Criss and Belch Huggins and the rest of them. What a bunch of losers they had been. Stan Uris with his big Jew boy nose. Bill Denbro, who could say nothing but hi-yo silver without stuttering so badly that it drove you almost dog shit. Beverly Marsh, with her bruises and her cigarettes rolled into the sleeve of her blouse. Ben Hanscom, who had been so big he looked like a human version of Moby Dick. And Richie Tozier, with his thick glasses and his A-averages and his wise mouth and his face, which just begged to be pounded into new and exciting shapes. Was there a word for what they had been? Oh, yes, there always was. Le mot juste. In this case, le mot juste was wimps. How it came back. How it all came back. And now he stood here in his den shivering as helplessly as a homeless mutt caught in a thunderstorm. Shivering because the guys he had run with weren't all he remembered. There were other things. Things he hadn't thought of in years, trembling just below the surface. Bloody things. A darkness. Some darkness. The house on Niebold Street and Bill screaming, "You could kill my brother, you fucker!" Did he remember? Just enough not to want to remember anymore. And you could bet your fur on that. A smell of garbage, a smell of shit, and a smell of something else. Something worse than either. It was the stink of the beast, the stink of it, down there in the darkness under Derry where the machines thundered on and on. He remembered George. But that was too much, and he ran for the bathroom, blundering into his Eames chair on his way and almost falling. He made it, barely. He slid across the slick tiles to the toilet on his knees like some weird break dancer, gripped the edges, and vomited everything in his guts. Even then, it wouldn't stop. Suddenly, he could see Georgie Denbro as if he had last seen him yesterday. Georgie, who had been the start of it all. Georgie, who had been murdered in the fall of 1957. Georgie had died right after the flood. One of his arms had been ripped from its socket, and Rich had blocked all of that out of his memory. But sometimes those things come back. Oh, yes, indeedy, they come back. Sometimes they come back. The spasm passed, and Rich groped blindly for the flush. Water roared. His early supper, regurgitated in hot chunks, vanished tastefully down the drain, into the sewers. Into the pound and stink and darkness of the sewers. He closed the lid, laid his forehead against it, and began to cry. It was the first time he had cried since his mother died in 1975. Without even thinking of what he was doing, he cupped his hands under his eyes, and the contact lenses he wore slipped out and lay glistening in his palms. 40 minutes later, feeling husked out and somehow cleansed, he threw his suitcases into the trunk of his MG and backed it out of the garage. The light was fading. He looked at his house with the new plantings. He looked at the beach, at the water, which had taken on a cast of pale emeralds broken by a narrow track of beaten gold. And a conviction stole over him that he would never see any of this again, that he was a dead man walking. "Going home now," Rich Tozier whispered to himself. "Going home, God help me, going home." He put the car in gear and went, feeling again how easy it had been to slip through an unsuspected fissure in what he had considered a solid life. How easy it was to get over onto the dark side, to sail out of the blue and into the black. Out of the blue and into the black, yes, that was it. Where anything might be waiting. 3. Ben Hanscom takes a drink. If on that night of May 28, 1985, you had wanted to find the man Time magazine had called perhaps the most promising young architect in America, Urban Energy Conservation and the Young Turks, Time, October 15, 1984, you would have had to drive west out of Omaha on Interstate 80 to do it. You'd have taken the Sweet Home exit and then Highway 81 to downtown Sweet Home, of which there isn't much. There you'd turn off on Highway 92 at Bucky's High Hat Eat-em-up. Chicken fried steak our specialty. And once out on the country again, you'd hang a right on Highway 63, which runs straight as a string through the deserted little town of Gatlin and finally into Hemingford Home. Downtown Hemingford Home made downtown Sweet Home look like New York City. The business district consisted of 8 buildings, 5 on one side and 3 on the other. There was the clean-cut barber shop. Propped in the window, a yellowing hand-lettered sign fully 15 years old read, "If you're a hippie, get your hair cut somewheres else." The second-run movie house, the 5 and Dime. There was a branch of the Nebraska Homeowners Bank, a 76 gas station, a Rexall drug, and the National Farmstead and Hardware Supply, which was the only business in town which looked halfway prosperous. And near the end of the main drag, set off a little way from the other buildings like a pariah and resting on the edge of the big empty, you had your basic roadhouse, the Red Wheel. If you had gotten that far, you would have seen in the potholed dirt parking lot an aging 1968 Cadillac convertible with double CB antennas on the back. The vanity plate on the front read simply, "Ben's Caddy." And inside, walking toward the bar, you would have found your man, lanky, sunburned, dressed in a chambray shirt, faded jeans, and a pair of scuffed engineer boots. There were faint squint lines around the corners of his eyes, but nowhere else. He looked perhaps 10 years younger than his actual age, which was 38. "Hello, Mr. Hanscom," Ricky Lee said, putting a paper napkin on the bar as Ben sat down. Ricky Lee sounded a trifle surprised, and he was. He had never seen Hanscom in the wheel on a weeknight before. He came in regularly every Friday night for 2 beers and every Saturday night for 4 or 5. He always asked after Ricky Lee's 3 boys, He always left the same $5 tip under his beer stein when he took off. In terms of both professional conversation and personal regard, he was far and away Ricky Lee's favorite customer. The $10 a week and the $50 left under the stein at each Christmas time over the last 5 years was fine enough. But the man's company was worth far more. Worthwhile company was always a rarity, but in a honky-tonk like this, where talk always came cheap, it was scarcer than hen's teeth. Although Hanscom's roots were in New England and he had gone to college in California, there was more than a touch of the extravagant Texan about him. Ricky Lee counted on Ben Hanscom's Friday-Saturday night stops because he had learned over the years that he could count on them. Mr. Hanscom might be building a skyscraper in New York, where he already had three of the most talked-about buildings in the city, a new art gallery in Redondo Beach, or a business building in Salt Lake City. But come Friday night, the door leading to the parking lot would open sometime between 8 o'clock and 9:30, and in he would stroll, as if he lived no farther than the other side of town and had decided to drop in because there was nothing good on TV. He had his own Learjet and a private landing strip on his farm in Junkins. 2 years ago, he had been in London, first designing and then overseeing the construction of the new BBC Communications Center, a building that was still hotly debated pro and con in the British press. The Guardian, perhaps the most beautiful building to be constructed in London over the last 20 years. The Mirror, other than the face of my mother-in-law after a pub crawl, the ugliest thing I have ever seen. When Mr. Hanscom took that job, Ricky Lee had thought, well, I'll see him again sometime, or maybe he'll just forget all about us. And indeed, the Friday night after Ben Hanscom left for England had come and gone with no sign of him, although Ricky Lee found himself looking up quickly every time the door opened between 8 and 9:30. Well, I'll see him again sometime, maybe. Sometime turned out to be the next night. The door had opened at 9:15, and in he had ambled, wearing jeans and a Go Bama t-shirt and his old engineer boots, looking like he'd come from no farther away than cross town. And when Ricky Lee cried almost joyfully, "Hey, Mr. Hanscom, Christ, what are you doing here?" Mr. Hanscom had looked mildly surprised, as if there was nothing in the least unusual about his being here. Nor had that been a one-shot. He had showed up every Saturday during the 2-year course of his active involvement in the BBC job. He left London each Saturday morning at 11 a.m. on the Concord, he told a fascinated Ricky Lee, and arrived at Kennedy in New York at 10:15 a.m., 45 minutes before he left London, at least by the clock. "God, it's like time travel, ain't it?" an impressed Ricky Lee had said. A limousine was standing by to take him over to Teterboro Airport in New Jersey, a trip which usually took no more than an hour on Saturday morning. He could be in the cockpit of his Lear before noon with no trouble at all, and touching down in Junkins by 2:30. "If you head west fast enough," he told Ricky, "the day just seems to go on forever." He would take a 2-hour nap, spend an hour with his foreman, and half an hour with his secretary. He would eat supper, and then come on over to the Red Wheel for an hour and a half or so. He always came in alone, he always sat at the bar, and he always left the way he had come in, although God knew there were plenty of women in this part of Nebraska who would have been happy to screw the socks off him. Back at the farm, he would catch 6 hours of sleep, and then the whole process would reverse itself. Ricky had never had a customer who failed to be impressed with this story. "Maybe he's gay," a woman had told him once. Ricky Lee glanced at her briefly, taking in the carefully styled hair, the carefully tailored clothes, which undoubtedly had designer labels, the diamond chips at her ears, the look in her eyes, and knew she was from somewhere back east, probably New York, out here on a brief duty visit to a relative or maybe an old school chum, and couldn't wait to get out again. "No," he had replied. "Mr. Hanscom ain't no sissy." She had taken a pack of Doral cigarettes from her purse and held one between her red, glistening lips until he lit it for her. "How do you know?" she had asked, smiling a little. "I just do," he said. And he did. He thought of saying to her, "I think he's the most god-awful lonely man I ever met in my life." But he wasn't going to say any such thing to this New York woman who was looking at him like he was some new and amusing type of life. Tonight, Mr. Hanscom looked a little pale, a little distracted. "Hello, Ricky Lee," he said, sitting down, and then fell to studying his hands. Ricky Lee knew he was slated to spend the next 6 or 8 months in Colorado Springs, overseeing the start of the Mountain States Cultural Center, a sprawling 6-building complex which would be cut into the side of a mountain.
When it's done, people are going to say it looks like a giant kid left his toy blocks all over a flight of stairs, Ben had told Ricky Lee. Some will, anyway, and they'll be at least half right. But I think it's going to work. It's the biggest thing I've ever tried, and putting it up is going to be scary as hell, but I think it's going to work.
Ricky Lee supposed it was possible that Mr. Hanscom had a little touch of stage fright. Nothing surprising about that, and nothing wrong about it either. When you got big enough to be noticed, you got big enough to come gunning for. Or maybe he just had a touch of the bug. There was a hell of a lively one going around. Ricky Lee got a beer stein from the back bar and reached for the Olympia tap.
Don't do that, Ricky Lee.
Ricky Lee turned back, surprised. And when Ben Hanscom looked up from his hands, he was suddenly frightened. Because Mr. Hanscom didn't look like he had stage fright or the virus that was going around or anything like that. He looked like he had just taken a terrible blow and was still trying to understand whatever it was that had hit him.
Someone died. He ain't married, but every man's got a family. And someone in his just bit the dust. That's what happened, just as sure as shit rolls downhill from a privy.
Someone dropped a quarter in the jukebox, and Barbara Mandrell started to sing about a drunk man and a lonely woman.
You okay, Mr. Hanscom?
Ben Hanscom looked at Ricky Lee out of eyes that suddenly looked 20 years older than the rest of his face, and Ricky Lee was astonished to observe that Mr. Hanscom's hair was graying. He had never noticed any gray in his hair before. Hanscom smiled. The smile was ghastly, horrible. It was like watching a corpse smile.
I don't think I am, Ricky Lee. No, sir, not tonight, not at all.
Ricky Lee set the stein down and walked back over to where Hanscom sat. The bar was as empty as a Monday night bar far outside of football season can get. There were fewer than 20 paying customers in the place. Annie was sitting by the door into the kitchen playing cribbage with the short order cook.
Bad news, Mr. Hanscom?
Bad news, that's right. Bad news from home.
He looked at Ricky Lee. He looked through Ricky Lee.
I'm sorry to hear that, Mr. Hanscom.
Thank you, Ricky Lee.
He fell silent, and Ricky Lee was about to ask him if there was anything he could do when Hanscom said,
What's your bar whiskey, Ricky Lee?
For everyone else in this dump, it's Four Roses, Ricky Lee said. But for you, I think it's Wild Turkey.
Hanscom smiled a little at that.
That's good of you, Ricky Lee. I think you better grab that stein after all. What you do is fill it up with Wild Turkey.
Fill it? Ricky Lee asked, frankly astonished. Christ, I'll have to roll you out of here.
Or call an ambulance, he thought.
Not tonight, Hanscom said. I don't think so.
Ricky Lee looked carefully into Mr. Hanscom's eyes to see if he could possibly be joking, and it took less than a second to see that he wasn't. So he got the stein from the back bar and the bottle of Wild Turkey from one of the shelves below. The neck of the bottle chattered against the rim of the stein as he began to pour. He watched the whiskey gurgle out, fascinated in spite of himself. Ricky Lee decided it was more than just a touch of the Texan that Mr. Hanscom had in him. This had to be the biggest goddamn shot of whiskey he ever had poured or ever would pour in his life.
Call an ambulance, my ass. He drinks this baby and I'll be calling Parker and Waters and Sweet Home for their funeral hack.
Nevertheless, he brought it back and set it down in front of Hanscom. Ricky Lee's father had once told him that if a man was in his right mind, you brought him what he paid for, be it piss or poison. Ricky Lee didn't know if that was good advice or bad. But he knew that if you tended bar for a living, it went a fair piece toward saving you from being chomped into gator bait by your own conscience. Hanscom looked at the monster drink thoughtfully for a moment and then asked,
What do I owe you for a shot like that, Ricky Lee?
Ricky Lee shook his head slowly, eyes still on the stein full of whiskey, not wanting to look up and meet those socketed staring eyes.
No, he said, this one is on the house.
Hanscom smiled again, this time more naturally.
Why, I thank you, Ricky Lee. Now I am going to show you something I learned about in Peru in 1978. I was working with a guy named Frank Billings, understudying with him, I guess you'd say. Frank Billings was the best damned architect in the world, I think. He caught a fever and the doctors injected about 1 billion different antibiotics into him and not a single one of them touched it. He burned for 2 weeks and then he died. What I'm going to show you, I learned from the Indians who worked on the project. The local popskull is pretty potent. You take a slug and you think it's going down pretty mellow, no problem. And then all at once, it's like someone lit a blowtorch in your mouth and aimed it down your throat. But the Indians drink it like Coca-Cola, and I rarely saw one drunk, and I never saw one with a hangover. Never had the sack to try it their way myself. But I think I'll give it a go tonight. Bring me some of those lemon wedges there. Ricky Lee brought him four and laid them out neatly on a fresh napkin next to the stein of whiskey. Hanscom picked one of them up, tilted his head back like a man about to administer eye drops to himself, and then began to squeeze raw lemon juice into his right nostril.
"Holy Jesus!" Ricky Lee cried, horrified.
Hanscom's throat worked, his face flushed, and then Ricky Lee saw tears running down the flat planes of his face toward his ears. Now the spinners were on the juke, singing about the rubber band man. "Oh, Lord, I just don't know how much of this I can stand," the spinners sang. Hanscom groped blindly on the bar, found another slice of lemon, and squeezed the juice into his other nostril.
"You're gonna fucking kill yourself," Ricky Lee whispered.
Hanscom tossed both of the wrung-out lemon wedges onto the bar. His eyes were fiery red, and he was breathing in hitching, wincing gasps. Clear lemon juice dripped from both of his nostrils and trickled down to the corners of his mouth. End of side 2.